Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to another edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. We've got True Religion filing bankruptcy, a Kroger lawsuit against Lidl that's on everyone's tongues, and how food stamp programs may affect grocers, and the cutback of food stamp programs may affect grocers in the next couple of years. We'll talk also, leading the show, about Quick Trip's expansion in Texas. But first, our podcast brought to you by Third Wave Water and ThirdWaveWater.com. If you ever wonder why the coffee you brew at home doesn't taste quite as good as the coffee you get in a coffee shop, it's because those coffee shops spend a lot of money conditioning their water, and now you can do the same thing at home for as little as 10 cents per cup using their patent-pending formula. Visit ThirdWaveWater.com. Use the promo code FOCUS for 10% off your first order.
We are also brought to you by WarbyParker.com. as they provide very modern and stylish eyewear, prescription eyeglasses starting at $95. Warby Parker was founded with a rebellious spirit and a lofty objective to offer designer eyewear at a revolutionary price point while leading the way for socially conscious businesses. Get a free 5-day home try-on at warbyparkertrial.com/focus. 5 pairs, 5 days, 100% free. Again, warbyparkertrial.com/focus.
We begin our show with the C-Store segment, with convenience stores, as Quick Trip announces massive expansion plans to Austin and San Antonio. This is an announcement that flew under the radar initially in the convenience store industry, as Quick Trip put out a press release on Wednesday afternoon, July 5th. As I mentioned, this flew under the radar despite the fact that Quick Trip puts out a new press release about once every 16 months. So it was very noteworthy in that they found the news worth publishing on their website, but also revolutionary in that they're expanding their total store count by 15%.
A little bit about the Quick Trip franchise and the Quick Trip as a company. Tulsa, Oklahoma-based and privately held Quick Trip operates 750 stores in 11 states currently and is 59 years old. Their last big expansion actually came in 2011 with additions in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Greenville, South Carolina metropolitan areas. They added 36 stores in Charlotte and 30 in Greenville and Spartanburg. So this expansion, as we'll see, is actually going to be much larger. Currently located in Tulsa, Wichita, Kansas, Kansas City, St. Louis, Phoenix, Tucson, Arizona, Charlotte, Greenville, Atlanta, Dallas-Fort Worth, Des Moines, Iowa, and Omaha, Nebraska. Much like other convenience stores, they view growth as a market-by-market proposition. So they'll go into the market and expand from there, rather than adding isolated stores in a broader area as a typical retailer might. This trend was broken last year as they added some one-off stores in Wagoner, Oklahoma, and Muskogee, Oklahoma. Unlike other smaller convenience stores like older 7-Elevens, for example, Quick Trip operates in a similar vein as a Casey's might. Their newest third-gen model is actually about 20% larger than previous stores they have in their portfolio, coming in around 6,000 square feet, whereas Casey's stores are also fairly large, approaching around 5,000 square feet for their new models. Their main differentiator from Casey's is price, undercutting Casey's by about 25 to 40% across the board, and because of this, they have a cult-like following akin to 1-7-Eleven, once enjoyed popularity of the Slurpee and other unique items there. Also widely known for cleanliness and being well-staffed at all times of the day. Throughput is also a specialty with multi-register systems and registers able to service multiple lines because of their rounded counters. Seldom are lines invasive to other areas of the store. This is very unique to their operations. Recently, the register system has been adopted by Casey's and new convenience store builds in other parts of the country. But Trent, this story is about their expansion, and it would be nice to look into the details as to where they're expanding and why and how it might affect the surrounding markets.
So Quick Trip did announce Wednesday their intention of opening stores in the South I-35 corridor in Texas. This will span both San Antonio and Austin markets. Now, it's likely that their brand in this area already has substantial awareness. They have Quick Trips, of course, north of there, in Dallas-Fort Worth, and also markets both east in Atlanta in the south, and then west as far west as Phoenix and Tucson, as Leighton mentioned. Their first stores in this expansion grouping are scheduled to open in summer 2018, with construction beginning in just a few months here in this upcoming winter. Their goal appears to be over 100 stores in these two markets alone, as they've referenced a boost of at least three figures in their press release. This would represent growth of around 15% over their current store count, which Leighton mentioned was over 700. One emphasis they have in building out these stores for Quick Trip is their QT Kitchens concept. Quick Trip, going back 10 or 20 years, they were much more of a retailer-type convenience store. They didn't have a lot of ready-to-eat food outside of what was on maybe the rounded grill units in the front of the store. They had a lot of prepackaged food, but basically it was like a smaller edition of a Walgreens, a CVS, a Rite Aid, more like your drugstore than it was a convenience store, only without the pharmacy. But they've slowly begun to renovate these stores to include QT Kitchens concepts in the back. So these are back-of-the-store concepts that are basically like a smaller version of a grocerant. If you think of a grocerant that might be in a Kroger or in a Whole Foods, QT Kitchens are similar. They have pizza, sandwiches, shakes, and ice cream-based items, as they have soft serve machines now installed in the back of most of their stores. And sure, they still serve purpose as a grocery store would. They have a vast selection of not only convenience store items, but also products where people can go there, because they are open in most markets 24/7, and get items while the grocery store or while another store is closed. But all of these new locations will actually have their back of the store QT Kitchens built right in. And I think it's important also to keep some perspective about this deal as they expand further south in Texas. In terms of market size, for those that aren't really all that familiar with southern Texas, San Antonio is right around the 30th largest market in the United States. So to put that in perspective around other cities you might be more familiar with, Kansas City, San Jose, right in that same population niche. Now, Austin is a little bit smaller. Their metro area number 41 through 43, usually, depending on which data set you look at. That's about Indianapolis sized in terms of market. However, these two markets are growing rapidly. San Antonio, from 2015 to 2016, was growing at the third fastest rate of any metro area in the country. And when you look at Austin, they're one of the fastest growing metro areas really over the past 7 to 8 years. According to the U.S. Census Bureau's five-year survey, Austin's metro area grew 16% from 2010 to 2015. That's second only to New Orleans in the U.S., and realistically, looking at it, a lot of New Orleans population growth was driven primarily by people returning to the city after the Hurricane Katrina aftermath in the late portion of the last decade. So all other things equal, Austin is either the second fastest or the first fastest growing metro area in the United States, and Quick Trip obviously feels it's important to gain a foothold in these markets. Leighton mentioned earlier that they've opened around 30 stores in the Greenville area, around 30 stores in the Charlotte area, but again, looking at over 100 stores between these two markets, they want to blanket these markets in a state where they already have a substantial presence. They have 134 stores in the Dallas-Fort Worth market, which they entered back in 1999, taking on competitors largely in 7-Eleven and then also the smaller gas stations, so Mobile's On the Run concept and so forth. We talked about their brand penetration in the South earlier in the story when we were talking about how customers in Austin and San Antonio likely to be familiar with this Quick Trip concept. And actually, that's something that Quick Trip mentioned in the press release, the fact that they feel like they have great brand awareness in these areas, and the fact that Quick Trip is kind of that viral type brand. Just a matter of opening these stores is going to drive customers through the door and going to take away some of that market share from their competitors. And speaking of their competitors, Leighton and I looked a little bit deeper at who their competition might be in these new markets.
Well, in Austin, there are a ton of locally owned convenience stores, but 7-Elevens are widely prevalent. You see, 7-Elevens do have a wide selection of ready-to-eat food offerings, but do fall short on the kitchen's concept. Circle K's also exist there as well. 7-Eleven's square footage seems to be less than the proposed Quick Trip's, with Circle K being right in line with them. And if you look in the metropolitan area, the more denser urban locations, you'll typically see a 7-Eleven have around 3,100 square feet, or at least that's according to some newer developments that have happened around the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And 7-Eleven competes with Quick Trip in Dallas, while Circle K competes with them in Phoenix. We see that in San Antonio, Valero and 7-Elevens currently control the landscape there. There are other smaller convenience stores affiliated with Exxon and Shell as well. Likewise, it appears as though Quick Trip square footage will be more vast than any of these competitors, especially with these Gen 3 stores. And you'll see those smaller layouts, those different concepts that you'll see with the Exxon and Shell locations, some are actually only around 15 to 2,000 square feet. So really building out their square footage and their overall footprint, which will help to drive brand awareness. Important to note that Racetrack, often considered Quick Trip's largest competitor in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and Atlanta with square footage and product mix, does not have a presence in San Antonio or Austin. Possible future white space for Quick Trip. As referenced earlier, they choose to expand by immersing themselves completely into certain markets. However, this has been tested recently as they've been choosing to open high profile and large square footage locations into smaller markets near their headquarters. In terms of Texas, they could either decide to go down further the I-35 corridor to Laredo and the Rio Grande Valley, or potentially east towards Houston. We move on to fashion with True Religion as they file bankruptcy. Most known for their upscale denim assortment, True Religion has come under hard times as the retailer has failed to lure the same demographic in as they have over the last decade. They are actually privately owned by Tower Brook Capital, a private equity firm that has offices globally. Pieces of their portfolio, you see that they have fashion-oriented businesses like Caporal Jeans, but other holes include finance operations, media consulting groups, and even a partial partnership stake in the St. Louis Blues. But Trent, it looks as though after seeing a surge in sales throughout the last decade, they really have come under these hard times, and that's resulted in this bankruptcy notice.
Specifically, they were founded in 2002, and at that time, they quickly gained a lot of traction, growing to create $490 million in revenue by the time 2013 came around. So you see it's a relatively quick fall from grace for True Religion. The company itself is headquartered out of Manhattan Beach, California, and all the company employs about 1,900 people, and they have a store base of 140 locations. This number of locations is reflective of the 20 they've already closed. They closed those 20 in the last fiscal year. The official news of this bankruptcy filing came out on Wednesday, with the company's management looking to restructure the internal strategy along with its debt load. Chapter 11 bankruptcy is shown to already be helping with certain lenders, as they'll be accountable for approximately only 25% of this overall debt load. However, this does come at a cost. If the company is looking to trade for its equity, this will save the company $350 million, according to filings. It's easy to wonder what exactly the creditors valued the company at after having been aware of its struggling financial state over the last 2 years. They'll also be getting another lease on life, aside from the bankruptcy, in the form of an optional $60 million credit line from Citizens Bank. Now, oftentimes when you see a company enter bankruptcy, you'll see them seek out additional credit lines as kind of additional elbow room or wiggle room to get their finances in order and get their business operations in order. Sometimes companies struggle to find this line of financing, but it's a good sign long-term for True Religion that they were able to do so, in this case from Citizens Bank. And there are a number of things to blame here. Leighton and I have talked multiple times about the struggles of some fashion retailers in mall outlets and that type of thing. True Religion falls right in with this group, and that's one of the biggest reasons why they've come up with these financial struggles over the last 2 years, is it seems as though they've been taken down with the rest of the sinking ship.
Some potential foibles that have been in place here. You see that there's been direct blame on the retailer and its management as far as their fashion scheme is concerned, but especially with upscale fashion, it's very hard to try to adjust with the market. We're saying that it's very easy to get off trend as not only the demographics change, but consumer tastes change. and we were talking about some analysts that had talked about the fashion industry over the past few years, and you see very quick mentions of social media there and how one Instagram post from a popular figure could change the entire landscape for the next couple of years. It's very interesting, a very interesting dynamic. Overall, it does affect these companies, both privately held and publicly held, but those fashion trends are often hard to predict, and they are often tied with the brand itself. For instance, a lot of what the Buckle has done to come to prominence was not only in their styling, but the brand they had worked to build up. Now that retailer is also seeing struggling same-store sales, as we reported a couple quarters ago on the Buckle. But despite the industry being one of an unpredictable status, many still find specific things to blame for this particular bankruptcy: lackluster store merchandising and displays, a product that failed to evolve, and failing to bring customers into the online fray. We believe that the last two were the main culprits in reality. Their CFO actually said as much in the Chapter 11 filing, stating that in 2013, they, and I quote, "began experiencing declining sales caused by a general trend of consumers moving away from traditional retail to online shopping," end quote. And by traditional, he of course means brick and mortar. However, much before 2013, there was a pronounced shift in apparel sales. And looking back at historical figures from publicly traded companies, in terms of dollar amount, annualized dollar amount, The Gap, Abercrombie & Fitch, and J. Crew were all seeing online sales in excess of $500 million at that time. And if you compare to the overall revenue here with this retailer, you see that their online sales alone were trumping the overall revenue, the top line sales from this retailer. So we see what is interesting here about that 2013 date, the overall shift there. But not only that, this is when they were taken private by Tower Brook for around $835 million, or about two times their current revenue status. So some would call a very steep valuation, but the decline only got worse sequentially since 2013, and that has brought the company down to where they are currently. In the last fiscal year ending January 28th, they lost $78.5 million on just $369.5 million in sales. So you can see they've actually lost sales over the last 4 years. They've lost about 25% of its revenue, in fact. And that's really not the devastating part. It's the fact that they have apparently eroded margins. You see that because of the net loss there. Margins are what any upscale retailer has to survive by, because they are the additional cash that's needed for a typical apparel retailer to market and promote. If you're an upscale retailer, that really is your business. You're going to have to be a marketer. And this is in place to basically elevate your brand and keep relevant in your customers' eyes. Once this is gone, and once that allure has drifted, no matter what the financial engineering has for you, the company may be on a permanent downside. So, Trent, with all this said, we know that they will have an opportunity to exist, at least in the short term. So now what are they looking to do, and what are the potential repercussions of their current actions?
Well, to begin with, the company requested a federal bankruptcy judge's permission to cancel 29 leases, keeping in mind that they have over 100 stores currently. Now, the 29 leases are for 27 stores that are still open. Two of the stores obviously had fallen by the wayside prior to this. Now, this would leave them with 113 locations total, so they're looking to trim their location count even further to try and get some of their expenditures into line. True Religion will have an opportunity as well to adjust its business model, especially with that additional line of credit we talked about earlier. But at this point, it's still unclear what that business model could look like. We've seen some companies adjust to an e-commerce only business model. Some companies just kind of trim back a number of things that they're doing, a number of different product lines. And perhaps they could close all the stores except those located in the most popular spots and keep those going as flagship destinations for an online or an e-commerce business, and then funnel that money that you're saving into online marketing and to try and boost online traffic. But the reality of it is, too, that the brick and mortar stores help to drive e-commerce sales. All those businesses that Leighton mentioned earlier that started seeing additional boosts in e-commerce sales, J.Crew, Gap, all of those were able to use their brick and mortar presence to bolster what e-commerce presence they had. And we're seeing even other e-commerce first retailers begin to build out their brick and mortar presence, as we've mentioned in the past with companies like Duluth Trading. So I'm not sure that that's the best option, but it is certainly an option on the table for them. Their e-commerce platform currently, when you go there, it's not the best. They could certainly benefit from 360 visual merchandising and other photo tools. Unless you're already familiar as a consumer with their different styles and collections, it's very difficult to navigate the mobile site, as we were tooling around on that before this podcast. And also, there's something to be said for adjusting their price point. They could, in theory, reduce their pricing, kind of cut them down from that premium-priced retailer, and maintain quality and freshness if they intend to cut costs elsewhere. But this could be a slippery slope. This action, of course, could devalue the brand. As much as you're trying to drive sales, it's also going to hamper those margins. But they could look potentially to maybe short-term promotional pricing or more reward-based pricing to keep the remaining loyal customers. Currently, when we talk about these price points, short-sleeve shirts are around $99 and up. Their denim products, their jean products, and that type of thing can be well over $200, some selections nearing $400. So they're at this crossroads, and we see a number of apparel retailers at this same crossroads, one of which we've recently mentioned on the podcast, Joseph A. Bank. They had talked about potentially removing their promotional pricing. Now we see them jumping back into promotional pricing. So it doesn't appear as though there's one good way to do things when a retailer is struggling. The bottom line here, though, is this fall from grace was very fast and quick and happening.
It sure was. And just one quick last point here. It's not as though their selections and their merchandising were vapid. I think overall you're seeing that consumers are looking towards a different product. If you're comparing the products that they sell currently on their website now to the products they were selling 5, 10, 15 years ago, it's fairly the same thing. The designs are very similar. So I think overall, it's not a matter of merchandising, marketing, and trying to get your message out there. It is a matter of adjusting with the times. And this is something that the management is going to have to coordinate in the future and try to rebound from this bankruptcy.
When we return, we'll have an interview with Keith Rubenstein. He's the U.S. CEO of Kidzania USA, whose endeavor includes moving into former mall anchor spaces in an attempt to drive traffic by using experiential learning situations for children. To the listeners of the Retail Focus podcast, you ever wonder why the coffee you make at home never quite tastes as good as the coffee you buy at a coffee shop? Well, let me tell you the secret. If you're a longtime listener, you know the secret. You know what I'm about to tell you, which is that coffee shops spend a lot of money to make the perfect water for making coffee. But for as little as 10 cents per cup, you can duplicate that same effect at home.
That's right, you can. Third Wave Water has a patent-pending formula of minerals that, when added to a gallon of distilled water, makes for what they call coffee brewing magic. Recently at the U.S. Brewers Cup Championship, both the first and second place finishers brewed their coffee with Third Wave Water.
Check out their website at thirdwavewater.com. Use the promo code FOCUS for 10% off your first order. Again, time running out on this promotion. Visit them online at thirdwavewater.com. Use the promo code FOCUS for 10% off your first order. If you followed retail news at all over the past 3 years, you know that there is ample negativity surrounding the American shopping mall. Now, whether it's warranted is another question entirely, and we'll leave that for another show. But sky is falling conjectures by major media outlets are causing a lot of onlookers to wonder if the American shopping mall is really doomed. Our guest today, however, is seeking to turn around traffic trends in American malls. Keith Rubenstein is a founder of Somerset Partners, a private investment firm with commercial and multifamily property investments throughout the United States. Mr. Rubenstein's international relationships have enabled Somerset to expand its presence on a global level in conjunction with those partners. Rubenstein developed and expanded Somerset's core investment program to include significant commercial assets in major U.S. markets. Since 2000, Somerset has put together a strong track record on over $2 billion in acquisitions to date. Rubenstein
Bernstein is also currently spearheading the development of a new mixed-use real estate development in the South Bronx and is the acting CEO of Kidzania Today, which is why we're bringing him on the show today. Kidzania is the world's fastest-growing experiential learning center for children. It boasts 24 locations in 19 countries around the world. Recently announced inaugural U.S. locations in Dallas, Chicago, and the New York, New Jersey metro area. Keith, thanks so much for joining us today on the Retail Focus podcast.
Thank you for having me, Brent.
First, anyone that really follows retail knows that the indoor shopping mall is a constant target of negative press in the United States. And I think the question a lot of people might ask when they're hearing about Kidzania or hearing about anyone investing their time or their money in the mall space is, why exactly have faith in the American shopping mall? Why do you feel as though malls are something that can survive or be turned around in the U.S.?
I'm not an expert in retail or in shopping malls, but I've come to study them over the last couple of years and have my own opinion on things. And I think, like everything else in the real estate world, there are some well-performing assets and not well-performing assets. And I think it's just a question of supply and demand and maybe over-aggressive growth by some retailers. But I think that what, from our perspective, there are many malls that are doing well and that are active and that are full and catering to millions of people that visit them each year. So I think, like a lot of things, there's a lot of overemphasis on the declining state of retail and on the retail mall. But I think, like everything else in real estate, it's a supply and demand, and it's a cyclical process that's going through right now.
And certainly there are a number of malls in the country having vast amounts of success with their retailers within. I want to backtrack and talk a little bit about Kidzania. If a person or a listener of ours out there has never heard of Kidzania, never visited a Kidzania, how would you explain the overall concept to them?
I think the best way to picture it or imagine it is a giant miniaturized city where children govern, work, and populate these cities on a daily basis. So when you think about 100,000 square foot space, or roughly 100,000 square foot space, that have paved streets and cars and trucks and commercial traffic and retail establishments and restaurants and all the things that one would encounter in a metropolitan market like New York, Dallas, or Chicago, and everything is built and operated for children, that's what you would see if you looked into a Kidzania. And fortunately, there are 24 Kidzanias around the world, and they're very, very successful in each of the markets that they're in. And it really just creates a very, very detailed, exciting version of role play.
Within these Kidzanias, as you mentioned, you basically, they get populated with children every day, but children have to work, they do other things within. And to that extent, you guys have a number of partners. I know one of which is Domino's Pizza. Who are some of the other partners that are kind of on board with this project?
Well, there's international partners that have sponsored various venues in world markets where Kidzanias are, like DHL, Nissan, Coca-Cola, just to name a few. But each market that we are studying will have an international industry partner base, a local industry partner base, and a national industry partner base.
So coming from this real estate background that we talked about in the open, what piqued your interest about this Kidzania concept and got you to step on board as their U.S. CEO?
The first thing that captured my mind was the concept of it. Then, like everybody else, when I hear something, I research it, and, you know, probably one of the first things you do is Google something, and you see a lot of content online about Kidzania. But what really got me excited is when I went to visit one for the first time in Mexico City, and I saw the children interacting and being fascinated and being inspired and aspiring to be, you know, what their parents are, or what their role models are. It was really exciting. And when you see that on a large scale basis with thousands of children there day in and day out, I felt that it was something that I wanted to pursue in the United States and North America. And then when I thought about what we discussed earlier with respect to the current state of the retail market and the shopping mall experiences and what the retail center operator and owners are speaking to, which is to create excitement and bring experiential activities and increase foot traffic to the mall, I felt it was a perfect opportunity to launch in America.
one of the things you mentioned, kind of the current state of the U.S. mall and certain malls throughout the country. Some anchors are leaving, closing down, obviously Sears being perhaps one of the more notable ones. But these anchors typically are about the same square footage as an average or traditional Kidzania. Has that helped you a little bit, or might it help grow the concept out in the U.S.?
Well, I think it does, because everyone's looking for experience and everyone's looking for excitement. And, you know, maybe if you had to go and reinvent the retail experience, you could look at something that is not just racks of clothes or, you know, traditional shopping, but it's something that's exciting. And when I saw the opportunity in terms of what real estate values were, what possibilities in terms of rental rates are in shopping malls, that's what really interested me. And, you know, I think that what mall operators see when they see a Kidzania is an expanded amount of foot traffic that comes to the malls. And if the mall was relying on a traditional anchor that may not have been performing well, and then here comes Kidzania that'll bring a million or so people to the mall to shop and, you know, use the restaurants or go to the movies, I think it's exciting for both sides, and it creates, you know, that typical win-win situation.
With these 24 locations already throughout the world, obviously those locations generate a healthy amount of data. And as you've referenced, some of the data is indicating certainly that it's driving traffic. These Kidzanias are through mall doors. Have you been able, coming from that real estate background, to kind of leverage these known traffic increases that Kidzania locations get to kind of work out maybe not necessarily more favorable lease agreements, but certainly lease agreements that are, say, more amenable than for an anchor?
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly correct. And we don't have to be the one to educate the mall operator. The mall operators, generally, at least the ones that I've spoken to and become engaged with in terms of discussions on opening Kidzanias in their shopping centers, understand what Kidzania is and understand, you know, what the potential foot traffic and shopper basis will be by coming to their mall with a Kidzania, by understanding that a parent who shops with a child tends to shop a little quicker than if they don't have a child with them. And the point I'm trying to make is that when a child goes to Kidzania, they stay at a 4 to 5 hour session, so it gives the parents a lot of time to avail themselves of the other amenities and opportunities within the existing shopping center.
I want to touch on something there. You mentioned how parents can drop off their kids for 4 to 5 hours. The kids get somewhat of an enriching, immersive, educational experience. And a lot of people wonder, well, how do the parents track the kids? How do they know when to pick up the kids? And you've got this bracelet program that is really fascinating. What's been the feedback in the other markets behind the way parents and children can still communicate despite the children being at a Kidzania while the parents are shopping?
Well, it's been overwhelmingly positive because, first and foremost, the parent wants to make sure that their child is secure and safe while they're engaged in the activity of the Kidzania. And one of the things that we have is a very, very sophisticated security system and ingress and egress program. So there's one way in and one way out, and the child that came with the parent has to leave with that same parent. And the bracelets are married parent to child, and it gives the parent the ability to see and monitor what their child is doing on a regular basis. And we're also integrating that with mobile devices so that there can be video links as well. And there's a lot of technology involved that's getting worked on now. So I think it's very, very interesting and exciting. And it allows the parents to relax and understand that not just that their kid is being engaged, but they're having a great time, they're safe, and they're close by.
One of the stats that's been thrown around with the existing Kidzanias is that kids do become repeat customers, basically, of Kidzanias, where they're visiting 5-6 times per year. And that's another thing that maybe an onlooker that's not familiar with this concept might ask is, well, don't kids get bored and doesn't the novelty run out? What are some of the things that Kidzanias do in general to keep that return traffic coming back to the malls?
That's a really good question. And I think first and foremost, there's multiple different occupations that child can try and take part in within a particular venue within Kidzania. And the other thing that is happening is that the Kidzanias are constantly evolving, just like any other city. You know, when you walk down the street in New York City, you see some storefronts that are empty and some storefronts that are getting built out and some consistent ones that have been around for a long time. So we're constantly evolving the experience within Kidzania. so that a child who comes to Kidzania once, most of the time will want to come back. And the studies have shown from other markets where Kidzanias are is that each child tends to come 4 to 5 times per year. There's all different activities, so they can do the things that they want to do and repeat them, or they can try new things every time that they go there.
So we've talked to this point about the established popularity of these Kidzania's locations overseas. What are some of the, you know, obstacles, or what are some of the tricks that you guys are using to kind of tweak the approach and get it to where it will also work in the United States?
Well, I think the United States, we've studied the United States in terms of what's offered in terms of experiential opportunities for children, whether it be children's museums or amusement park or other novelty type establishments where kids go and spend time. And what's the most interesting thing about Kidzania is it takes education, it marries it with entertainment, and it produces something that we call edutainment, which gives the child practical experience to take what they're learning in school and apply it to real life settings. And every kid wants to role play. Role play has been around forever and ever. And this, as I said earlier, just takes it to a much more sophisticated level. And it inspires children to aspire. When you combine all of that and you take the educational component with the entertainment component, it creates something unique and exciting. And I think it's going to be very, very successful in the United States.
When you talk about motivation for the kids that are coming into these locations, obviously, one of the questions that I think a parent would ask, and this veers a little bit from retail certainly, is what type of feedback do you give the kids? How do you keep the kids motivated to be functioning within the Kidzania? What are some motivation mechanisms you have in there for the children visiting these locations?
The most important motivational aspect is compensation. So when a child comes into Kidzania, they get a bank account, and whatever they do, they earn a wage. And depending on what they do will determine what the wage is. And then they can go buy things, whether it's food and beverage or games, toys, or other things within the Kidzania store. And it's exciting for them. And, you know, my personal research from children that I've spoken to that have visited Kidzanias around the world are very, very interesting. One is the most enjoyable thing about Kidzania is the ability to earn money, right? The second thing, which is the least favorite thing for kids to do, is to spend money. So they start to get a real-life experience as to what it is and what it means to be economically responsible. So I think, you know, when a child does something and gets rewarded for that in terms of whatever his or her salary for that particular task that they have done, I think that creates excitement. And I think it makes them proud, and I think it makes them want to come back, and I think that it gives them practical experience that they may not get otherwise.
It's certainly interesting that potentially a shopping mall could teach economic responsibility for children. We don't often think of it in those terms. I want to ask something in terms of you taking over Kidzania and kind of taking the reins in the United States. How different has it been for you coming from the real estate sector to kind of adjust and suddenly work in something that is a little bit different than what you're used to on a day-to-day basis?
Well, it's really exciting for me because, you know, my practical experience in real estate is on the other side as a landlord trying to convince tenants to come to our properties, whether they're residential, commercial, or retail. And it's nice to be on the other side where it's the landlord trying to convince us to come to the properties based upon the merits of that particular center. So I think it's really exciting, and I'm really excited to be a part of it. And I think that we will be very, very diligent in growing this brand and choosing the centers that are optimal for our launch.
You mentioned diligence. Of course, your first three U.S. markets are going to be three very major markets in the New York, New Jersey area, Chicago, and the DFW area as well. Long term, where do you see this concept headed? Do you see this as a concept that can expand maybe beyond the top 10 markets in the U.S.?
Yeah, I see this in 15 to 20 locations in the U.S. and several more in Canada. And actually, we're studying one right now in Toronto, which I think is a great market for Kidzania.
All right, Keith Rubenstein, the U.S. CEO of Kidzania. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Retail Focus podcast.
Thank you for having me.
You know, Leighton, I'm looking forward to something in September, and it's not, believe it or not, the start of the NFL season. It's shop.org, the National Retail Federation's annual digital conference in Los Angeles.
And Trent, we will actually be there in their podcast booth. They've afforded us the ability to be interviewing the people, the guests that are going to be attending at that Los Angeles show between September 25th through the 27th. And there's some interesting speakers there that I would implore any of our listeners to go and see during this conference. We have Kobe Bryant as one of the keynote speakers. Also, Tyra Banks talking about her influence and her experience in the entrepreneurship setting, both in retail and in e-commerce. So a lot to be taking in. And if you go now, you can go to shop.org and you can save 10% by using the promo code FOCUS10. Again, enter the promo code FOCUS10 to save 10% as you register to visit this once-in-a-lifetime conference.
Reps will be there from Goop, DSW, Sam's Club, Staples. It's like a who's who of retail brands. Again, that's shop.org. Save 10%. When you sign up for the conference in LA by using the promo code FOCUS10. Well, we pick up more news on the Retail Focus. This was in the news towards the end of this week, and it was just about everywhere you clicked on mainstream media websites. Kroger has filed a lawsuit against Fresh and New grocery retailer in the U.S., Lidl, for trademark infringement regarding their private label brands. This actually gives us an opportunity to say Lidl correctly. It is Lidl, not Little, as we were originally led to believe. Lidl already has opened stores, about 20 of them, through parts of North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia. Their U.S. headquarters is stationed in Arlington, Virginia. Leighton, they want quick growth, and they want to try and compete with all the established grocery brands. But here, in the case of this lawsuit, one of the established grocery brands seems to have a little bit of a problem with Lidl.
Yeah, absolutely. Kroger does have a foothold in parts of the Southeast and along the East Coast with different store brands and banners. But the company and Lidl is focused on quick growth with plans of opening up to 80 through this exact region throughout the next 12 months along the eastern half of the United States is where they're focusing their business. Long term, they're looking at several hundred locations, over 300 locations to be exact, over the next 5 years. The company's management has been clear on their strategy to win over customers, saying they will be more efficient and cheaper while providing equivalent or better quality merchandise. The company has massive roots dating back over 50 years with 10,000 locations now in 25 countries in all of Europe, and they are, of course, privately held. One takeaway from the company's underlying vision is the value in which they wish to create for the many consumers here domestically. Before opening the stores, management was actually on several media rounds. Management put on several previews for analysts and potential customers to see. One of the main aspects highlighted was their private label selection, which encompasses both upscale items such as international cheeses, but also everyday essentials such as fish and poultry and other dry goods. In all, the company touted 90% makeup of private label brands in their individual stores and an average footprint of around 20,000 square feet. So again, 90% of their store is going to be made up of all of these different private label brands. And one would think because they are an international company, a company headquartered in Europe, you're saying that a lot of this merchandise could be construed as something coming as an import. However, 85%, according to U.S. CEO Brandon Proctor, will actually be brought in by United States food distributors. So about 85% of their 90% product mix is actually going to be stemming from the United States. So that's a good sign if you're living here in the States. The differentiating factors with Lidl's private brands seem plentiful too, where they will be able to be free of artificial dyes, trans fats, and MSG. So something that is going to be differentiating them there. But perhaps the biggest strength will lie in the Lidl Love It guarantee with their private label brand, which states that customers can replace and refund any private label item they are not satisfied with, given any reason. So this is a very interesting guarantee, something that a lot of retailers have tried in the past, but obviously you see a lot of customers trying to take advantage of that. Fast forward to now, Trent, there is a lot of important detail as to why Kroger has brought a lawsuit alleging Lidl's messaging on their private label brands.
So we've established through the first part of this story that private label brands, very, very important for Lidl, but they're also very important for Kroger. Kroger, for their part, much larger company than Lidl, 2016 saw Kroger sales reach $115 billion, while recent sales figures for Lidl in Europe saw revenues topping $72 billion when converted to U.S. currency. So Kroger still larger than Lidl, despite Lidl's massive European influence, and Kroger's using perhaps some of their extra cash to now sue Lidl as they're alleging trademark infringement, and it all comes down to private label brands. Lidl's private label brand Preferred Selection, according to Kroger, is too similar to Kroger's Private Selection. This news came by way of Business Insider, who's looked at the lawsuit filings, and you saw a bunch of two to three paragraph briefs in news outlets throughout the country, but not too many of them really dug deep into some of the legalese of this situation. The lawsuit in this circumstance is taking place in the new home state for Lidl US through the District Court of the Eastern District of Virginia. Kroger's stance here is not that Lidl's products will make Kroger's good products appear lesser, but that they're using the likeness to potentially draw away traffic, having customers believe that they are the same company or affiliated with one another. To magnify the argument, Kroger claims to have built up their brand, the Private Selection brand, and brand awareness for over 20 years. Lidl's trademark for Preferred Selection was filed in September of 2016 here domestically. Now, Preferred Selection is something that was used in different equivalents overseas for Lidl, so this is not necessarily a new term for them, but it is certainly new to the United States. The basis of nearly every lawsuit in terms of copyright infringement or trademark infringement, the plaintiff has to prove out damages here, usually equating to some sort of a monetary figure. And here the lawsuit on behalf of Kroger says that they have suffered and will continue to suffer irreparable injury based on what they deem to be trademark infringement. The very definition of irreparable is a loss that is impossible to rectify or repair, so logically may make it unclear as to what exactly Kroger is seeking monetarily, at least, for restitution. To us, we're both non-lawyers, we should make that very clear, but it's conceivable that some see the merchandise and the similarities between the two. But looking at the two different logos, and we're obviously very familiar with Private Selection, looking at packaging for Preferred Selection from Lidl, they are not that similar. The word marks aren't that similar. The font isn't that similar, besides maybe the black background behind the text and a few colors like gold, for example, in the color scheme. So, Leighton, you did a great job at digging through some of these past legal cases to find where there might be some comparables for this particular case in the U.S.
Absolutely, Trent. Thank you so much. You know, in a parallel universe, I would be a lawyer, but it's just a lot of school, a lot of reading. And to be honest, I was a little bit too lazy when I started my college career, but it does interest me. A lot of U.S. common law does. And we dig through some of that U.S. common law to find some valid precedent for this particular case. We see in AMF Inc. versus Sleekcraft Boats 1979, we can see that there are no absolutes, but the court must consider around eight elements from the plaintiff. So in this case, the plaintiff is going to be Kroger. And we see that there are these eight elements that are going to be brought into the court to try to give perspective into how the Private Selection versus the Preferred Selection might be construed as the actual customer. So we see that one of these elements is going to be the strength of the mark. How often do they promote these individual preferred and private selection items? Proximity of the goods, similarity of the marks, evidence of the actual confusion, which is a very important note here because you have to prove out, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, but you have to prove out that there is solid confusion with your core customer. We also see types of marketing channels used, types of goods in question, the intent of the defendant, so the intent of the incoming party or Lidl in this case, likelihood of the expansion of marked product lines. So for this, we could see that it's not looking so good for Lidl because they are in the same exact business. They're in the grocery business selling dry goods, and this is their private label extension. So a lot of similarities coming together with this, and they're trying to do the exact same thing by having cheaper private label groceries that they can offer and try to build up that brand awareness for years. And that is one thing that Kroger mentioned there with their brand awareness, and that all the money they've spent over the last 20 years to try to market their private label brands and the value and quality that they bring to the table, that is important. However, in this particular case, the burden of proof, as is with most lawsuits, will be on Kroger. And having to prove actual harm has been very tough and costly with these types of lawsuits. The rate for trademark lawyers sits around $250 an hour. That's an average rate. And digging up each piece of evidence to prove harm can cost up to $100,000 per piece of evidence. That's according to InsideCounsel.com. And for this particular type of trademark infringement, plaintiffs will usually have to seek a consumer survey evidence. So pieces of consumer survey evidence will look like marketing research studies where random people are asked what they think about the difference between the two marks. So for instance, how similar they are from one another and their overall perception between the two things. So this type of thing is very costly, very expensive, because these professional studies are going to have to be done in a very accurate way in order to prove to the court that there is some detriment brought upon Kroger. And one may ask Kroger why they did not actually file in September when they saw the application for this particular trademark brought from Lidl. Well, again, they have to prove damages. And once Lidl was able to open their stores at the beginning of June this year, they were actually able to then look and say, look, they've brought a certain amount of traffic away from Kroger and to their own operations potentially because of this trademark. So we look at the now what of this, and we see that lawsuits like this can take a long time. But if Lidl has to rescind the name, they will have to be careful to not come up with anything similar close to what Kroger or other grocers in the United States have. U.S. trademarks last a long time. They last actually forever. So as long as they're in use, they're in effect. So this type is different than actual copyright law, which lasts for about 70 to 120 years. There's actually three types of copyright law here. But for this particular case, we're seeing that there could be no winners, Trent, because this is going to be a very costly and drawn-out process if they don't settle quickly. And in one of my undergrad classes, for a business law class, in fact, a law professor once said, no party usually decisively wins in these long, drawn-out cases, except for, of course, the legal counsel on both sides. So this is especially true here, where the two logos and wordmarks are very dissimilar, and you're seeing that there could be a lot of argument back and forth that could take years. But of course, in the meantime, they have to pay the lawyers involved. They have to pay the researchers involved doing those consumer survey studies. So a very interesting study, and one that I was very excited to talk about here on the podcast. It's not just as easy to say, listen, one party is suing another, but there are further implications, further repercussions for the brand new Lidl inside the United States. This might make them pump the brakes a little bit on the further expansion while they have to deal with this on the wayside.
Well, speaking of long-term impacts, for our final news story here on the podcast, we look towards food stamp programs. And we've talked about before, we know that anytime food stamp programs are reduced, it tends to hit retailers, particularly grocers, hard. Now, a new study suggests that the impacts could be even more severe than originally thought. We spoke last month about a White House proposal to make cuts in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program over the next decade, also known as the SNAP program. It was argued at the time, and still is, that many of the cuts would have happened naturally as the country approaches full employment and has seen marginal growth in wages. It was still seen as a major blow by some to the grocery retail sector. And now, Leighton, we have a new study that suggests that the thesis from the retail side appears to be true. This is a new study from CNBC in coordination with Alex Partners. And there appears to be evidence here to suggest that the financial impact will be quite large if changes to any of these nutrition programs come to fruition. Of the $191 billion slated to be cut, over $70 billion is said to affect supermarkets such as the aforementioned Kroger, but also the Walmarts and the Targets of the U.S. As we last discussed, 2016 saw grocery stores and general merchandise retailers take in 81% of overall SNAP usage. Therefore, given the $70 billion mark over the next decade, that's a potential of over $55 billion in lost top-line revenue or overall sales at those merchants. Now, an economist would pivot to the notion that these are assumptions made on having the past and present be equal. And this is a good point, as we can't use necessarily past data, especially from the last 2 to 3 years, towards future data, particularly when, as I've already mentioned, a lot of people are pointing towards the country going further and further towards full employment, and the overall economy may be better or worse in the upcoming 10 years. We don't really know one way or the other. So the amount of groceries sold could actually outpace sales with the added SNAP benefits from prior years. And there's also the population as well, which is expected to grow in the coming years. By 2025, in 8 years, it is estimated that the U.S. may have 30 million more humans. Now, it depends on the estimate you go to and look at, because as we've talked about in the past on Retail Focus, there are a lot of millennials, a lot of people in the younger generational age groups that are not reproducing or choosing not to have children. So these growth rates in terms of population, they could be skewed by either the birth rate or the immigration rate, certainly. But also people are remaining alive for a longer time, generally speaking, over the last 50 years. Now, a generalized look at opportunity costs also come into play here. In theory, a proposed reduced tax rate would lead to increased consumption and consumerism. Again, this is in theory. We're not going to get into the politics of it necessarily. That's what some politicians would argue, at least. The increased amount that consumers have to spend, the less they're getting taxed, the more you're going to see spent at retail stores, at grocers, that type of thing. Therefore, the same dollars that aren't being directly used for the SNAP programs around the country could, in essence, be helping those same retailers through alternative purchases. It's kind of the same theory that goes along with substitute goods in a grocer, like what we've talked about with soda taxes on the Food Focus podcast. However, studies have shown that those in higher income brackets may actually choose to invest or save this additional money that they're not being taxed for, which would then be an indirect economic boost, which classical economists would argue is the way things should naturally be. And again, there's arguments going both sides here, but bottom line is, Leighton, it looks as though, based on this study, retailers, regardless of any of these substitute goods or any of this alternative purchase that is hypothesized, retailers, especially grocers, could stand to lose some money from this.
Absolutely. And this really isn't a situation where you're seeing that a food stamp recipient is going to receive X amount of dollars and now they're going to see zero amount of dollars. So we should also be clear on that, and that the Congressional Budget Office said that the average benefit per month is around $250, while this Trump's administration's SNAP benefit proposal will actually see amounts fall on an individualized basis to around $173 a month. So overall, you're seeing that recipients will still be getting some amount of money that they will be spending at these general merchandise and grocery retailers. But the Retail Dive did provide some solid, digestible insight as to actually what this means for these U.S. operators. So with Walmart, the largest grocer in terms of sales in the United States, they will, again, lose, in quotations, an approximated $12.7 billion in sales if this goes through over the next decade. Again, assuming they don't gain or lose market share overall in their respective industries. But you can see that Target could lose as much as $5 billion, around $4.8 was the actual figure there. Kroger could lose between $3.6 and $3.9 billion. Again, this is all estimations based on the previous numbers, but overall, an estimated 5.8% of grocery sales come via food subsidies, according to the Food Marketing Institute. And we see overall that this is really not an endemic program for some retailers. We were talking about the idea that only around 85% or so take advantage of these programs. It wasn't that long ago that retailers actually weren't qualifiers for taking in the SNAP sale. So overall, you're saying that this is going to affect a certain piece of the population, Trent, but you mentioned a very excellent point in that the economy is seeing sort of a resurgence, and you're seeing wages actually increase over the 2008 levels as far as the wage rates are concerned. So with full employment, or at least heading towards full employment, and then you're seeing increases in wages, you're seeing that a lot of people are able to buy groceries with their own money. So all politics aside, you're seeing that this does have a real money impact to a lot of retailers who do and are qualified with the SNAP program inside the United States. But anytime you're talking about money here, you're talking about an opportunity for retailers to actually grow their presence and reinvest that money, which could actually hurt jobs in the long run too. So that's a facet not a lot of people have talked about here. As retailers garner more income, they're more likely to expand and reinvest in not only their own company and store presence, but also those very people that are potentially taking part in these programs. So a lot to digest here, a lot of interesting ways to look at this program, but we thought it would be insightful to go back and look at something, a story that we've covered here recently, and how this is really playing out on the research side of things.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, where each Layton and I give you one story that we're keeping an eye on over the next week or next month. And we begin with Layton.
My looking ahead story has to do with companies we rarely talk about on the Retail Focus, and a deal that will actually bring together two companies that advertise in the TV space and have for some time. QVC is acquiring the Home Shopping Network. And to be clear, QVC actually did own a piece of the Home Shopping Network. Liberty Interactive Corporation, the parent company of QVC, actually owns around 38% of HSN, or the HSN parent, HSNI. And under the agreement actually announced this week, Liberty will acquire the remaining 62% of the company, making it a wholly owned subsidiary of Liberty Interactive Corporation. It's going to be an all-stock transaction, and it has an enterprise value approximated at $2.6 billion. So a massive deal here between very large companies that do a lot of online shopping, a lot of TV advertisement to try to boost different and new products in an innovative way. And this is interesting, Trent, because again, we don't talk about these types of stories very often. There's not a lot of news out there, and a lot of the companies involved are privately held. But overall, you see a consolidation. One could call this consolidation in an arena where they're losing some traction to the online space. And one of the areas that they're losing to is those YouTube channels. So you've seen over the last 6 months to a year, a lot of advertisement from these companies, a lot of promotion happening on YouTube. So YouTube is obviously a huge driver of ad revenue, but this is a way for them to also get their new products out the same exact way they've been doing with cable subscribers for over the last 20 years. So a very interesting merger of like companies here. I'm curious to see if they create any quote unquote synergies from this, or if we could see some job loss in the future, or just a combining of an effort to really try to gain back traction and gain back market share from those other companies who have been promoting a little bit better over the last few years.
And let's keep in mind, too, that with these television marketing companies or home shopping network type companies, they actually pay cable providers to carry their channels. It's not the other way around, where like a cable provider would pay ESPN a certain carriage fee in order to carry it. HSN, QVC, the like, they will actually pay your cable provider so as to deliver their channel into homes. And with more and more people cutting the cord, you wonder how that's going to affect the stability of their businesses long term. I'm looking at something a little bit more generalized. You know, Tesla has been in the news a lot recently, especially if you follow the stock market, because there's claims of Tesla being potentially overpriced, that their price to earnings ratio in this case is negative because they're not profitable as yet. Their stock price overall basically is a little bit over where it should be. And when I think about that, I think about Restoration Hardware, actually. You know, it seems like when we talk about Restoration Hardware on the podcast, we're typically talking about either negative or slightly negative things or something in relation to their rewards program. Well, Restoration Hardware, if you haven't followed them recently, their stock is up around 52-week highs. In fact, just earlier today, the day we're recording the podcast, they set a new 52-week high for the company. They're at around $69 per share, which is well over double their low of around $25 per share for the year to date that was set back in late February. And the reason I'm looking at this story is I'm kind of wondering if they're not a little bit overvalued by the market as a whole. They've come out with analysts talking about new inventory programs and inventory overhauls, but I'm not 100% convinced that it's fixed the issues at Restoration Hardware, or at least fixed the issues beyond where Restoration Hardware was having success 3 to 4 years ago. In fact, their current price to earnings ratio is up over 170, which kind of suggests explosive growth expected by the market. And considering their earnings in the second quarter were just 5 cents per share, I may not be seeing something that the rest of the market sees, but I know a lot of analysts are in the same boat with me. They are mildly optimistic about Restoration Hardware, but the market has taken this and really run with it. And you kind of wonder, and this is what I'm looking ahead to, if shareholders won't be disappointed at the next earnings call. During the last earnings call for Restoration Hardware, their stock dropped nearly 25%. You wonder if shareholders are setting this stock up for a similar drop when they next report earnings at the beginning of September. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent. Big thanks to our sponsors, Warby Parker, Third Wave Water, and shop.org. For more, you can visit us on Twitter at Retail Podcast or shoot us an email, retailpodcast@gmail.com. Until next week, so long.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.